On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Some men have a midlife crisis and buy a sports car. Bill Buford had a midlife crisis and ran into the kitchen. Not just any kitchen, but the wild, flaming, hellish heaven of the kitchen of superstar chef Mario Batali, and into the madness and romance of extreme Italian cooking. Bill Buford is one of the country's top writers and editors, a star himself at The New Yorker. Now he made himself a kitchen slave, slicing and dicing and grunting and sweating for the glory of half-crazed five-star cuisine, first in Manhattan and then into the hills and bloody butcher blocks of Italy itself. Up next on Point, extremely good writer Bill Buford's extreme midlife plunge into the heat of the Italian kitchen. Joining me now from Culver City, California, is Bill Buford. He was founding editor of Granta magazine. He's written famously about sweatshops and Lucinda Williams and English soccer thugs. He's the former fiction editor and now staff writer at The New Yorker. His new book is Heat, An Amateur's Adventures as Kitchen Slave, Line Cook, Pasta Maker, and Apprentice to a Dante-quoting butcher in Tuscany. Bill Buford, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much. You make me sound like a complete madman.
Well, you've gotten out there on the edge a little bit yourself in the course of this adventure. We're going to talk all about cooking in this hour, but get us situated in your life to begin with. I mean, here you're fictional at The New Yorker. The next thing we know, you're puttering through the streets of Manhattan with a huge hog draped over your Vespa scooter or whatever it was. What had you so keyed up to go off into that dark and flaming world of the kitchen?
A series of accidents, which actually began innocently enough when I was hosting a birthday party for a friend of mine, the writer Jay McInerney, a fiction writer. I was then a fiction editor. And Jay gave me a cast of characters to invite. I think I might have mentioned Mario because I knew that Jay knew Mario and gave him a call. And to my surprise, happy surprise, he said yes. He's rarely invited to dinner. People rarely cook for him. I was about to discover why. And I hung up and told my wife, and she was apoplectic with wonder.
Mario Batali to our humble home, the chef of chefs, the star of Manhattan.
In fact, you know, I sort of clean up the speech a little bit in the book, but in fact, she was swearing at me. She said, "What the are you doing? What do you think about? We got to have him over for dinner. Now what are we going to do?"
Right. Bill, define him for us. Some people will know him very well. Others may not know him at all. Who is Mario Batali, and what's his restaurant? What's it stand for in Manhattan?
Well, it stands for, in a city that's known for its Italian cooking, its Italian-American cooking, Mario runs a restaurant that's known for its authenticity. And it's more Italian than most other restaurants in America. It's certainly the best pasta you're going to get in America. But it's done with his own touch. He's like the master of intensity. And he goes to maximize all flavors and all experiences. And several times I've tried to get Mario to confess how much he weighs. And
he's big. He's red-haired. He dresses funny. He's out there all the time.
He's probably very close to 300 pounds.
Yeah.
You look at him and you think, this guy is just the embodiment of appetites. He's, it's sex and drink and food and desire. And he's like the sort of the expression of the insatiable. and he's, when he gets going, especially in the night, he's just out of control. I mean, on this particular occasion, he didn't leave until 5 o'clock in the morning. He'd taken over the entire home by then.
Read a little bit for us. It will give us a flavor of that evening when your Svengali began to get his hooks into you.
This is a little bit after, Mario had come along and my friends and Jay's friends were all there expecting great comedy. But in fact, in the end, there really wasn't much comedy, mainly because Mario didn't give me a chance. Shortly after my being instructed that only a moron would let his meat rest by wrapping it in foil after cooking it, I cheerfully gave up and let Mario tell me what to do. By then, he'd taken over the evening anyway. Not long into it, he'd cut the lardo into thin slices. Mario had arrived with a giant slab of raw fat. And with a startling flourish of intimacy, laid them individually in our tongues, whispering that we needed to let the lardo melt in our mouths to appreciate its intensity. The lardo was from a pig that, in the last months of its 750-pound life, had lived on apples, walnuts, and cream. The best song sung in the key of P. pig, Mario said. And Mario then convinced us that as the fat dissolved, we detect the flavors of the animal's happy diet there in the back of the mouth. No one that evening had knowingly eaten pure fat before. At the restaurant, we tell the waiters to call it prosciutto bianco. And by the time Mario had persuaded us to a third helping, everyone's heart was racing. But Tali was an impressively dedicated drinker. He mentioned in passing that on trips to Italy made with his Babbo co-owner, Joe Bastianich, the two of them have been known to put away a case of wine during an evening meal. And while I don't think any of us drank anything like that, we were by now very thirsty. The lardo, the salt, the human heat of so much jollity, and cheered on, found ourselves knocking back more and more. I don't know. I don't remember. There's also the grappa. Mario brought grappa. And the nocino. Mario brought nocino. And one of my last images is of Batali at 3 a.m, a stoutly round man with his back dangerously arched, his eyes closed, a long red ponytail swinging rhythmically behind him, an unlit cigarette dangling from his mouth, his red Converse high tops pounding the floor, playing air guitar to Neil Young's Southern Man.
Bill Buford reading from his new book, Heat, and it is quite a journey that he takes into the world of Italian cuisine, starting with Mario Batali's Babbo restaurant in Manhattan, heading right on into the Italian hills. Bill, set yourself up for us here a little bit. You're no wilting flower, written a lot, lived all over, the soccer thugs you've written about, of course, and much, much more. Soccer thugs very famously, but I'm still curious, what had you that primed up that this kind of wild man marching into your life would take you into his kitchen? Were you tired of writing and editing?
I think I was without knowing it. The following week, I went to my desk job, which was I was the fiction editor of The New Yorker. And like all editors, you're summoned to occasional ideas meetings. And David Remnick, the editor of the magazine, had summoned a bunch of us. And at the meetings, I said, hey, you know, I know you guys know this guy, Mario Batali, and I know he's sort of, you know, celebrity chef, blah, 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 Food Network, but you guys have got no idea. And we really should write a profile of him. And I didn't want to write the profile. I suggested Jay McInerney, in fact, and it was Remnick who took me aside and said, this is because Remnick thought I could cook. And I think the only reason why Remnick thought I could cook is I'd had him over for dinner a couple times. And one of the features of New York, where you know everybody's working too hard and they're all lazy and they all have people deliver bad food in bags, is that he actually thought I could cook. And that's only because he really, really can't cook himself. And so he said, I should do it. And I thought, you know, I'll do it, but I'll do it if I can work in the kitchen. And it always been I'd always wanted to work in a kitchen. I always wanted the knowledge that chefs have. And I always wanted, you know, I didn't know that many chefs, but I always wanted to put myself up and offer to work one day a week and cutting carrots or something like that. And I put the proposal to Mario. I said, Mario, we got great news. The New Yorker wants to run a profile of you. He said, yes. And I said, and I'm going to write it. And he said, yes. And I'm going to work in your kitchen. And he said, what? But he let me in. And the basic philosophy was, as long as you don't mess it up, you can stay. If you mess it up, you're gone. And I actually did mess it up quite a lot, but nevertheless, they tolerated me. And I started doing one day a week of prep work during the prep kitchen and helping out in the evenings. And it just grew more and 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 more until finally I was there full time.
And this at one of the tip-top restaurants in Manhattan, a restaurant where head cheese, octopus, beef cheeks, lamb's tongue, calf brains are no strangers to the menu.
What was that just it? Makes you go yum 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 yum. Just listen to that list.
I just want to rub my face in all that. What was it like to be at the bottom end of that, the kitchen slave? And why did you start there? I mean, it's not as though you'd never picked up a chopping knife. You'd never cooked anything. Kitchen slave. Why? And what was it like?
Well, I think in the eyes of my new colleagues, I was a complete dysfunctional. I was sort of regarded as the village idiot. They actually thought I could cook, just like you. Mm. And on my first day, I'd been given the tour, and I hadn't realized there's a tradition in American restaurants that grows out of cooking schools. And the cooking schools have what they call externs. And the externs, to finish their degrees, have to do 3 months in a professional kitchen. And Babbo, being a very high-profile restaurant with a high-profile chef, got sort of the creme de la creme of the cooking school externs. And I was filling an extern slot. And the prep chef, Elisa Sarno, really thought I should be able to cook. Mm. I rapidly disabused her of that notion when she told me to bone, I don't know what it was, like 4 boxes of ducks with a dozen ducks in each box. And she rapidly went through the whole thing, telling me to make sure I get the oyster of meat and then departed. And I thought, oyster of meat. Wait a minute. What, you know, oyster, mollusk-like thing in the ocean, yeah. Doesn't have wings. Right. Duck, thing with wings that doesn't have wings. And I just made a complete, I'd arrived without my knives. I know I didn't mean to have knives. I arrived without my marker pen. And then within 22 minutes, I'd taken Elisa's knife because she had to loan me her knife and dragged it very effortlessly and sort of beautifully from the tip of my front fingernail right back to the knuckle. And there's this great eruption of blood. And Elisa looked at me and she said, "Don't tell me you've cut yourself." And I said, "No, really, you know, I do this kind of thing all the time. It's my eyes. I'm nearsighted or farsighted, shortsighted, well, all of them, actually." And I said, "Don't tell me you're going to have to go to the hospital. You've been here how long?" And I thought, oh, boy.
My guest, Bill Buford, along of The New Yorker, fiction editor there, brought David Eggers and Jhumpa Lahiri and lots more into prominence there, has been all around himself, but in midlife found himself drawn to the kitchen, drawn through the kind of magnetism of Chef Mario Batali. Batali's on the Daily Food Network. His show's called Molto Mario. Let's listen for a second. Here he begins instruction on an Italian dessert.
Now, the first thing we're going to make is a beautiful ricotta pie, and we're going to take some fresh ricotta. We're going to take two eggs and a white, and we're going to, well, we're not going to take that white. We're going to take that, we're going to make that three eggs. And one of the things that's important to realize when you're in the kitchen is that there's always flexibility. You're alone in the kitchen, and no one knows if that extra white went in there.
Molto Mario sounds so sweet, but when he gets revved, he's really revved. Bill Buford followed him, and even the roots beyond him in his new book, Heat. You can join our conversation. What do you think? What's the irresistible allure of slicing, dicing, searing, brining, boiling, basting, cooking? And do you know Mario, Molto Mario, from the show? Would you follow him? Would you take him as your midlife guide? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Bill Buford, you start in that kitchen. You follow the roots of it right back to Italy. But put us there just for a moment. Here we are, top of the Manhattan food pyramid in a way. What's the setting like? What's this kitchen look like? And we know from your title, it's hot.
It's very hot. The first night that I worked there, I was helping out with the plating of pasta, which is to say, really, I was doing nothing. But it was a way of learning how the kitchen worked. And I was standing next to the executive chef, who was then Andy Nusser. And he's on one side of a edifice called the Pass. And the Pass is where the cooks, the line cooks, put the plates when they're done. And then the executive chef hands them over to a runner. And then a runner runs out with them into the kitchen. But on the other side of the pass are the line cooks, and it is they are working a line of heat devices. There's the pasta maker, there's the grill, there's two flat iron stoves, and there's a normal stove, and then there's nothing but ovens underneath. And it's all cranked up to maximum heat, and it's been cranked up to maximum heat actually since midday. And when you walk back there, within inches of just passing the pass, the heat hits you like a physical object, and my pores just dilated wildly, and I could feel the hair on the back of my head just curling up and shriveling, and it's a very, very, very intense heat. And I thought, whoa, it's going to be a long time before I'm ever back there. That's not where I want to be. But actually, within about 6 weeks, I was cooking on the grill.
Which was a big step up, a lot of responsibility. You took a knock there, as I recall. One night, Mario Batali came in, didn't like, what was it, your undercooked tenderloin of pork and overcooked rabbit? You were bounced.
Well, you know, Mario was away. He was doing something. And I started cooking on the line, and I sort of did okay. And then I did okay, and then I got a little more confident, and maybe I got a little cocky. And then when he came back, I've been on the line for about 6 weeks, and I think he was a little surprised to see me so comfortable in the kitchen. Mm. And there's, by that point, that's when the new dynamic kicked in. I was no longer sort of writer guy. I was like the new guy in the kitchen, and he started scrutinizing my preparations like he would scrutinize everybody else's. And at one point, I put up a pork tenderloin on the pass, and he looked at it, and it was a little too pink. And then I put up a rabbit loin on the pass, and he looked at it, and he thought it was a little too done. And I got fired. Someone else took my place on the line, and I was pushed off into a corner and was given the responsibility of seasoning the meat. And it was a very crucial moment in the kitchen because I think every cook, they explained to me later, every cook gets fired at some point. In a French tradition, it's called plating, where the chef takes your plate, doesn't like it, throws it on the floor, breaks it, and you got to clean it up and then start the next thing. And it's a great sort of humiliation in the kitchen. And this is my humiliation. And it was a tricky moment for me. You know, I thought, I'm standing here like an idiot trying to make myself invisible while everyone else is now doing the things that I was doing. And I thought, do I go home? Oh, and if I do, this is over.
And it's your new crazy buddy who sort of sent you into this tailspin.
That's right. It would change the dynamic. It was like a welcome to reality. Friendships don't count here. We're in the kitchen.
You give us a lot of the mechanics of that kitchen that we rarely see and know little about. Remind us, I mean, it's small, but it works all day long, different shifts, sort of prepping on all kinds of things. Mario out front, but just a raft of Latins, whether they're called, you say, whether they're from Mexico or Paraguay or you name it, kind of doing the yeoman's work of getting this food prepared. I mean, a very different picture behind the kitchen door from what the diners are experiencing out in their candlelit realm.
Very few of us are really, I mean, we're all involved in eating some kind of prepared food. That's just a feature of our life. You know, one of the great luxuries of our life is when we get to eat in a restaurant and people serve us. But very few of us really knows what goes on behind the swinging doors of a kitchen. And that was the world that I walked into. It's a box with no windows, with this unbelievable heat, and everybody, especially in an American kitchen where the idea is high turnover, high performance, lots of plates, turn the tables, someone at 6, someone at 8, someone at 10, oh, why not someone at 11:30 as well? It's a very, very high stamina, almost athletic event, and it attracts a very weird kind of person.
You write about it almost a madness or insanity, your word, required to hit the heights, and it's very high heights. I mean, this gets, you know, very high star ratings all over the place. Why the insanity factor to hit that height of cuisine?
There's something about, you know, there's only a certain kind of people who want to spend 14 hours of their day in a hot box without socializing with anybody, working when everybody else is playing, working in that kind of heat, working with their hands, working with their eyes. And more than anything else, getting off on the adrenaline. Because when a kitchen gets hit, at Baba would be the first service sometime between 6:15 and 6:45. Everybody's eating, everybody's ordering, and there's more than you can physically do. And it's actually exhilarating. It's just complete buzz. And either you get that sort of, it's like a valve that you have to kind of open up. And either the adrenaline comes coursing out of it and you're keeping up with everyone else and you're loving it, or it doesn't and you're in big, big trouble. And the kitchen's just like a adrenaline junkies, all of them. They go for these moments at 2, 3, sometimes 4 times a night, but usually 2, 3 times a night where they're just it's just wild buzz.
A frenzy of labor, maybe even artistry, but it's got to be perfect when it comes out. I want to turn to our listeners. A lot want to join you, Bill Buford. Richard's calling from Messina, New York. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi. Listen, I really like what this gentleman's saying. I agree with a lot of it. I've been in his position a little bit, that I looked at the romanticism, and I've been in and out of cooking and in and out of journalism and some other careers. But I wanted to point out that there's one problem, and that's that there's so much American cuisine that is just really badly made in kitchens that are not following the rules, in with people. It's all about leadership. You know, if you have a chef with integrity, and I think that's not that common necessarily, then they're going to do things right. They're going to use the right ingredients. They'll follow the sanitary rules especially. But, you know, I've been in so many, you know, hotels and small restaurants and things, and I just see everything being done wrong. And I think that that's, you know, currently there's a big romanticism with cuisine and such, but there's a lot of stuff that's being done 100% wrong, particularly from what I see from a sanitary standpoint, but also just the way things are done, especially in bigger institutions.
Let us put it to Bill, Richard, and thanks for your call. I mean, Bill, you really went on the trail sort of getting back to the old relic here, back all the way back to Italy itself. We'll go there with you. But out at this American end, you're working in a very rarefied corner of it, but what about Richard's sort of disenchantment with what he broadly sees?
They're very good points. The reality is that, you know, and kitchens have their inspectors. But the reality is a kitchen is largely an unexamined space. And it's people working under a lot of pressures, not just the pressure of performance, but a financial pressure, especially if the chef is having to perform according to a budget or perform to meet his own financial targets. Mm. And it's true. I have to admit, I was you know, his other point is that the leadership of the chef is crucial, and I think that's when a restaurant expresses itself in the quality of its food. There's no question that when Mario was in the kitchen, the whole kitchen was different. I mean, when Mario was in the kitchen, the whole kitchen went completely silent. And it was, he had this amazing authority where he would, you know, he would just take apart dishes right on the spot. And his message was sort of an uncompromising seriousness. Mm-hmm. And that was the message that he was trying to convey straight through the whole kitchen. So they're very good points, but I was in a pretty privileged environment, as demanding and as wild as it is. It's going to be naturally sort of always verging on the out of control.
Richard, thanks for your call. Mary's calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
And I wanted to expand upon what Richard said, as well as this gentleman. I'm sorry I didn't catch your
Bill
name.
Buford, author of Heat.
All right. Well, being a chef and recipe developer and tester, I think that leadership is key, but you're actually a maestro in, you know, the symphony of the kitchen, and there's grace under pressure, and when you get into the zen of being in the weeds, is what we call it, then it is exhilarating, as you said, and it's one of the heights of passion to be able to have this grace under pressure and cook and deliver a piece of art, ultimately.
Amen. We hear it, Mary. Thank you very much for your call. We're at 800-423-TALK. Bill, that sort of zen zone clearly was pulling you in deeper and deeper. I mean, as you said, you spent more and more time. Finally, even decided to make the jump to go from that New York kitchen to the kind of old country, right to the source of where this was coming from. What was it that pulled you so deep and then across the sea to Italy?
Well, there are two things going on in an American kitchen, especially an American kitchen that's doing some kind of European cooking. And one is what we're all talking about, which is their high-performance operations in which, yes, very often you're in the weeds or you're getting hammered. Those are all expressions in the kitchen. But, you know, finally, Babbo was an American restaurant doing a version of Italian cooking. And there was a universal recognition among all the cooks that if you really want to know Italian cooking, you've got to go to Italy. And I think the same would be true of French cooking or any other cooking that's deriving its inspiration from another source. That was the, you know, Mario did the same thing. He went to Italy. He had a sort of a life crisis and perhaps was enjoying too many experimental drinks and other drier substances and felt that he had to get out of the country very quickly. And he ended up in Italy working for a small family in the hills above Bologna where he learned how to make pasta and learned the whole Italian touch thing. And while I was there at Babbo, you know, sort of cook after cook did the same thing where they would leave and felt they had to go to Italy. And finally I decided, you know, I've really got to go to Italy too. It wasn't so easy because unlike the United States where you have this whole facility of taking on externs. In Italy, so many people want to be doing this that now it's a whole protocol with visas and permissions. Mm-hmm. And it's a whole kind of every kitchen in Italy now has people coming from Japan and the United States, Australia, France even, wanting to learn this Italian touch thing. And but that was finally something that I felt I had to have.
Walk us through your stations of the cross there, the different cook chefs you worked with on your way to the ultimate, the butcher. But take us in.
In the beginning, I wanted to learn pasta. Pasta became a kind of obsession. And I approached a number of different women chefs. There was Miriam Leonardi, who ran a little place called La Buca, just outside of Parma. There was Valeria Piccini, who runs a great restaurant called Da Canino in Tuscany. And I had occasions where I'd met them or ate at their restaurants, and I phoned them and said, hey, how about me? I'll work for you for free. And they panicked. And in the case of Miriam, she said, sure, give me a call when you're in Italy next. And, you know, you can come by one afternoon, maybe a day. And I said, no, I was thinking about, you know, like a month or, you know, like a stage or maybe like 3 months. She started hyperventilating and hung up on me until finally I went to work with Mario's people in Porrette Terme, which is a little hill town between Florence and Bologna, and that's exactly where Mario learned how to make pasta. And I worked for this astonishing butcher named Dario Cecchini, which Mario also has a connection with. When Mario's father, who was an executive at Boeing, suddenly felt dissatisfied with his life and looked at his son, who changed his life by going to Italy and rediscovering food, Armandino, that's Mario's dad, quit his job and decided, I'm going to learn Italian meats, and went to Italy, and his first stop was this butcher shop, Dario Cecchini's. And that is on a hill town in the middle of Chianti wine country, 900 people, exactly halfway between Florence and Siena. And I persuaded my wife that really what she wanted to do was give up her high-paying editorial job at a New York magazine and accompany me to a hill town where, if I'm lucky, someone would allow me to cut carrots. And if I'm lucky, they would allow me to work and we would know nobody. And that's where we would spend, I thought in the beginning, just a couple weeks. But when I got there, it was the real deal. And we were so into something big and deep and mysterious and other that we left after 2 weeks because we had a commitment back in New York. And then 10 days later, we were back in Italy. And I thought maybe another month. And then we left after another month. And then we immediately turned around. And then we went back again. And we had an occasion in London where we were changing flights. And my wife and I were having a cup of coffee. And I said, we got to go back to Italy. We can't go back. We have to go back to Italy. And we hopped on the plane and went straight back. And we were there for 6 months. And then I was there the following summer for 3 months, and you know, I'll be going back again this summer.
And the Tuscan butcher, Dario Cecchini, had your number right from the start. He greeted you quoting Dante, saying, midway through the road of life, I found myself in a dark wood on a lost road. Once you were lost, but found there with a butcher. I mean, even the cutting and butchering became a passion for you.
Well, in Tuscany, it's, you know, every region of Italy has it expresses its culture and its food. And Tuscany is actually famous for its beans, but what I hadn't realized is that it's really, really famous for its beef. And in the same way that someone in Emilia-Romagna would, you know, get all caught up in recipes for tortellini or something like that, or some kind of handmade pasta, in Tuscany it's beef. And you go to an American butcher, and there might be, like, I don't know, a half dozen basic cuts, or maybe even a dozen basic cuts. But you go into a Tuscan butcher, and there's something like 50 basic cuts just in the leg alone of what you can do with your meat. And so I was going there to learn this whole zen of Tuscan butchery and the whole Italian touch thing. And led on by this guy, Dario, who does quote Dante, he's got the Inferno memorized. It doesn't take much to provoke him, and he's suddenly off reciting the Inferno, and the whole butcher shop has to stop while Dario goes on and on and on with whatever canto he's reciting at the time.
Alessandra's calling from Yarmouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Alessandra, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, how are you?
Very well.
I am from Tuscany, Florence, so I've been here 13 years, and my point right now is to... I had a hard time understanding why people here in America, Cape Cod, that's where I'm from, have rush through things. You know, I used to go back home from work and sit down and have my lunch and take the time, and that's missing here. And you know, the food is totally different, obviously, but I think we can start by just taking the time to enjoy what we're putting in our mouths and go from there.
that fits straight into Bill's program. Bill, the sort of issue of pace takes us to the kind of centrality of food. It became kind of your holy grail. Slow down, taste it. Alessandra says she misses that in the USA.
That's a very sound point. I was trying to make that earlier implicitly. And in an American restaurant, it's sort of speed and money. And it's speed of preparations, and it's money because you want to get in as many covers as you can, and you turn the tables and you get in maybe three different seatings. That's very different from an Italian kitchen or a European kitchen, where the idea is really, you know, you have the space for the evening. One of the Dario Cecchini is the eighth generation of butchers in his family, and when his father died, he had no intention of being the butcher. He was going to break the tradition. But his father died, and he gave him a deathbed imperative, which was, you know, I've done all these things for you, but what I haven't done was teach you how to cook meat. And what you need to do, prepare meat, and what you need to do is go to the maestro. And this is this legendary figure in the Tuscan hills, whose real name was Orlando. But go to the maestro, and the maestro will teach you how to recognize good meat, and then the rest you can learn. And in the early days, Dario was in a panic, and he was trying to do everything fast, and he was trying to rush and catch up and learn to be this butcher and learn to be able to take over from his father. And the maestro said, no. You can be busy, but if you're doing things in the old way, you have to do them slowly. You have to do them carefully. You cannot do them fast. And in a way, it was kind of the whole ethic of the place is you do the things in the old way, and you don't rush. You appreciate and learn what you have. And, you know, the same thing applied in the butcher shop. Every day we would close the butcher shop and we'd have a 2-hour family meal. And we'd put out a tablecloth. We'd put out wine. We'd put out bread. We'd make the food ourselves. And it was the time of day when everything stops and your life is organized around food. And it becomes food as not just a messenger of the culture, and it is, you know, you'll be eating whatever is the preparations of the place, but it's something deeper. It's social, it's family and social. It becomes then about food is the occasion for a more profound thing, interaction.
Alessandro, don't give up on that. Keep it alive right where you are. Bill, there's a great passage where you yourself were under the supervision of the maestro, learning to bone pigs that would be made into arista. Tell us about what that is, and I wonder if you'd read a little bit of this. It really, really brings the scene to life for us.
This is an old Tuscan preparation, and it harks back to when I think it was in the early 1400s, the two sides of the church, what was then, what was about to become the Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church, met for a meeting, and a pig was prepared, which had been boned and stuffed with lots of things. And the tradition is that the prelates at the end of the meal said, Aristos, Aristos, meaning Greek for the best. You can get it all over Tuscany in different preparations, but Dario has his own specific one, which involves boning the pig. And it was my first day with Maestro, which was a great, great moment. Dario's arista uses not one cut, but nearly half the pig, the torso, which is boned and rolled up with an extravagance of herbs and seasonings. Garlic, thyme, fennel pollen, pepper, rosemary, double ground sea salt. The logic is that each new item is applied in increasingly larger quantities. So by the time you get to the pepper, the meat is covered by a thick black blanket, followed by an abundance of rosemary, a green blanket, and completed by the salt, which, being twice ground, looks like a dollhouse replica of a blizzard. It is then cooked at a high temperature for 4 hours, emerging from the oven as a noisy, sizzling racket, the fat rendered and popping in the roasting tray, trailing a black, acrid cloud of smoke, a glistening and rather beautiful thing. When sliced, you get a range of cuts, the kare, tasting like a tender steak, the bacony stomach, and everything in between. But it is an unquiet food, which sends your taste buds in many directions. The slice manages to be both burnt and tender, caramelized and salty, lean and fatty, and exploding with both rosemary and fennel, and you can't eat much. This was what I was to prepare at 6:15 in the morning, when I stood in front of two halves of a pig, cut lengthwise, knife in hand, no mace glove, ready to start. The maestro was going to show me how to remove the bones from one half. I was going to do the other. He took my knife, and his initial instruction went something like this. Guarda, watch. You do this, così. You do that, così. You cut these, tagliali, one by one. You work the spine loose, and basta. He handed me the knife.
Bill Buford reading from his new book, Heat. Just wonderful. Marcelo is calling from Southampton, Massachusetts. Hi, Marcelo, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Actually, I know a couple of friends of mine who work with Mario, and he's actually one of the good celebrity chefs. There's a lot of them out there that have really no skill, like Emerald and a lot of other guys. So that's probably a good book to write. But one of the feelings I do have is like, these guys, it's just food. And I am a chef. And it's like, first of all, you talk about the illegal immigrants that are in this kitchen. They are illegal immigrants. They make no money. It's for them to have this great life, to travel to Italy, to have all this terrific things. And it's really like a really dirty business to be in. What do you think about that?
Bill, there's the chef. He says, you're the lucky one. It's a dirty business.
You know, it's the business is a quick course in reality. I don't actually say that the immigrants working at Babbo are illegal, but I did was introduced to a whole culture of Latins, as they call them, rather racistly, who carry New York kitchens, and it's the reality of labor. It's the cruel reality that you have to pay as little as you can to get as much as you can. And unquestionably, American restaurants are carried by this sort of dubious labor of the Latins, who in fact are great cooks because they come from a tradition. Well, in New York, the view is that the best pasta makers, for instance, come from Puebla in Mexico. And I met with some of them and hung out with some of them and got to know them and got to know the way they sort of did things on the weekends and became friends with the Babbo cooks from Puebla. And as they pointed out, you know, they're not particularly good pasta makers. They just understand food. They don't go to restaurants. They don't go to McDonald's. The McDonald's is way too expensive for them. They learn how to make food. So they come to a kitchen, and they have something that most Americans don't have, which is they've grown up making food. And it points to sort of an interesting moment in American culture, which I think there's probably never a point, possibly in the history of civilization, when people know as little about cooking as we do now. And that's one of the things that, for me, explains the popularity of, like, the Food Network and things like that. And so there's this not entirely happy relationship with the people who are doing most of the food, preparing most of the food in American restaurants. That's a very good point.
The glorious cuisine and fanciness you described, riding along on kitchen slaves who aren't all visiting from the New Yorker. Marcelo, thanks for your call. Lori's calling from Hampstead, New Hampshire. Hi, Lori, you're on the air.
Hi there. Can't wait to read the book. Just from listening to the conversation and reading the few reviews that I've read, it sounds like you have captured the in-the-weeds moment. And having been there, done that, can't wait to read the book and relive it. I'm wondering, the slow foods movement in Italy.
Slow food movement, yeah.
Slow food, the whole attitude of the joy of preparation, the joy of presentation, and the whole sort of abhorrence of the McDonald's in the middle of Piazza Navona. Are you seeing any evidence of that movement here in the States? We have the whole foodie wave, and that's been great, but the piece about slowing down and enjoying it doesn't seem to be there.
Local food, slow food, is it crossing the Atlantic, Bill?
I think actually it is happening. This is a movement that was started in Italy, and they produce a guide. They produce a guide of restaurants, a guide for the best wines. And you know, it was interesting to see how the slow food movement is viewed in Italy by people like Dario Cecchini, who himself is kind of an embodiment of it. And I think they're all a little suspicious of movements. They're all individualists and don't really want to belong to a club that will have them as a member. But that is, in fact, what the serious cooks in Italy are doing. The great winemakers, the good olive oil makers, the good butchers, the good restaurants is there paying attention to ingredients. And as a result, the food is more expensive and the wine is more expensive and the olive oil is more expensive. I actually think you're starting to see that here. I'd be happier if it just sort of happens, you know, if more people buy food from their local green markets. In Manhattan, the local farmers market, which sells only local ingredients, is a huge, huge, huge success. And my hope is you're going to see more attention to actual homegrown ingredients that cost a little bit more. Like in sort of a real animal's, real beef costs much more than mass-produced beef, but you're rewarded by something that tastes much better and tastes much healthier.
Bill Buford, with the unforgettable image of you with your scooter taking home 200 pounds of pig through the streets of Manhattan. Also, great moments in here, food and sex. I mean, the eroticism of food you go to again and again, especially when you're making your tortellini.
That's true. The whole thing started at Babbo when everyone went on and on about cooking with love and how, you know, in their ideal arrangement, they would they wouldn't be working in a kitchen, but they'd be cooking privately for people. And when I got to Italy, and learned how to make pasta from the woman who taught Mario how to make pasta, her prized achievement was making tortellini. And tortellini has got a whole erotic history. It was meant to be Venus's navel. It was meant to be this and that. The most persuasive and the one you hear the most often is that it was made by a baker and bologna to resemble the navel of the woman he was having an affair with, the married woman he was having an affair with, and the navel was done with such verisimilitude that her husband spotted the likeness, and all hell broke loose. And it is true. I mean, they're a nightmare to make, because you really need sort of little dinky fingers, and all the action takes place on the surface of your tiny little pinky. But when you're done, and if you haven't squashed the thing, and you turn it over, there's no question. It looks like a navel. I don't know. You look at it and go, well, I guess it's erotic.
Press it all together, form a ring. When you turn the pasta over, you'll be astonished by what you created. A belly button, what can I say, writes Bill Buford. It's wildly erotic. Bill, it's a terrific story, terrific romp. We're glad you took it. It sounds like you've survived all right. Your wife's still with you on this journey?
She's still hanging in there.
Oh, boy, what a ride. Bill Buford, thank you so much for joining us. Terrific book and terrific talking with you today. Thanks a lot for coming.
Thank you very much.
This is On Point.